You guys hear me back there? Okay. It's good to see you guys in the summer semester of Cornell. Because there's less of you, both you and I are going to have to get comfortable with staring at each other more because I can't look into just general, you know, areas in the room. Especially if you guys in the front have to get comfortable with that. I see some new people that I don't know. So my name is Alex. I'm a pastoral intern here. That's basically it. I'm a pastoral intern. please come say hi after service. I'd love to get to know you if I don't know you already. So the other day I was looking at the news and I heard that, if you guys follow the NBA Finals, that Justin Bieber was present at one of the games. And after the game, he called a 6'4" fan something that he shouldn't have called him, typical Justin Bieber. And they got into a fight and he ended up on the bottom of the brawl and got beat up. And I think because of his personality, that kind of abrasive, kind of aggressive personality that comes out a lot of times, he's one of the most hated celebrities by a lot of people in the country. But at the same time, he's one of the most adored and loved, right? And I think we can identify easily the fans of Justin Bieber. I'm not judging anyone in this room. I don't know if you guys are Justin Bieber fans, but Justin Bieber fans give up a lot to be his fan, meaning they give up their time and especially money to buy his CDs, albums, posters, I don't know, t-shirts, whatever, right? And you can tell that fans are fans if they give up these things, give up money in particular, because they love Justin Bieber. And I was looking at how much tickets to his concert costs, and the cheapest tickets went for $230 way back in, you know, way back in the hall. And in the front, right next to the stage, they cost $3,400 for a couple hours of Justin Bieber, right? So if you or me, if we saw anyone pay that much to just be in front of him, you know, you could assume confidently and guess very, you could assume that she or he, loves Justin Bieber. And I think we can do that because generally the time that we give up things for or the money that we give up things for, right? Where we spend our energy, our resources shows what we value, right? So if Black Friday comes around and you see a guy or maybe yourself, you've done this, you've camped out outside of Best Buy for 7 days just to get a sale, a TV on sale, right? It means you value getting that cheap, good deal. Or maybe something more closer to home, even if you've had a prelim the next day, you haven't studied for it, but you know that your favorite movie is going to play at midnight, you go anyway having not studied. It shows to people around you, right, that you value watching that movie over being prepared for your exam, right? So the things that you give yourself to, right, the things that you give your money to, your time to, your energy, your attention to, that's what you naturally, that's what you value, and other people can tell that by watching how you live and what you give yourself to. And in today's passage, there's a story about Mary. If you don't know Mary, she was one of Jesus' disciples and followers. And in this story, in John 12, she shows how much to all of us, to the world, to the people around her at the time, how much she loved Jesus by giving Jesus her everything, an expensive gift. And I think this story is important to meditate over. And the reason why I chose it is because it ought to jumpstart in us a questioning process. Why did Mary do such a thing? Why was she able and to give such a costly gift to Jesus? What did she see in Jesus? And I think as we meditate through this passage, I pray that God would lead us to wanting more of Jesus, wanting to see Jesus like Mary did, so that we would be so caught up with wanting to know God and Jesus, that we would be free from the things of the world free to serve Jesus and God. So, yeah, for those of you who are new, I've been going through a series from the Gospel of John examining who Jesus is. But in this case, in this passage, John 12, Jesus is in the story, but we learn about Jesus through the actions of Mary. So that's why we're going to look at her. So let's pray before reading the passage together. Dear God, as Dan already thanked you, I thank you again for drawing us to this place, closer to your presence, Father, and I do ask that you would please speak to us and feed us through your word. I ask specifically for all of us that you would create an insatiable hunger for you, to know your Son, to know you, Lord. Would you help us to orient our summer and really our lives to seeking you and to loving you, pursuing hard after you. For Father, only in your presence, only in the presence of you and your Son, will we be satisfied like Mary was, as we were going to see. So Lord, please wake us up if we are have forgotten of your goodness. Please show us again through Mary's actions that you are worthy. You are worthy of being pursued, Father. So be with us, Lord. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Okay, let's read the passage together. Let's do that. Let's alternate verses. It's on the board. Can you guys see that in the back? Hopefully there's not too much glare. Let's alternate verse by verse. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of perfume. Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? Jesus said, "Leave her alone, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial." When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came, not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. Because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. This is the word of God. So, the setting of the story is set in the first two verses, right? John tells us that what's happening in these passages? In this passage, is 6 days before the Passover. Most of you guys know what the Passover is. If you don't, it's an annual feast celebrated by the Jews of God rescuing the Israelites way back than when they were enslaved by the Egyptians. Right? God sent His angel of death to sweep over the lands of Egypt. Right? The angel killed every firstborn of the Egyptian slaves, the Egyptians who were enslaving the Israelites, but the angel passed over the Israelite houses, which were covered with the lamb's blood, right? That's why it's called Passover. So this is the feast that is happening soon, and Jesus, like every other Jew in the nation of Israel, is gathering, going towards Jerusalem, and Jesus decides to take a pit stop, if you will, in Bethany, the village of Bethany. And we're told that this village was where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. And if you know the Gospel of John, right, John dedicates all of chapter 11 to detailing this miracle. Right? Lazarus, in summary, right, Lazarus was dead for 4 days, really dead, right? Not just asleep. And Jesus comes and walks right up to his tomb. Everyone's sad, and him authoritatively, powerfully, He says, open up the tomb. And people are confused, but he knows what he's doing. And before all men, he's like, Lazarus, come out. He says three words. And Lazarus, once dead, rises and walks out of his tomb, still wrapped in the linens with which he was covered. Powerful story, right? Miraculous, probably the greatest sign that Jesus did in his earthly ministry. And he's come back to Bethany, right? And because he's come back to Bethany, and because people have, this is public news now. Jesus, this guy, right? He has raised Lazarus, who was dead for 4 days. He has raised him from the dead. And because of that, in verse 2, we're told that the village members probably, they gave him a dinner to honor him. For him. Right? So this whole passage is about Jesus. He's not doing a sign like some of the passages we've examined in the semester before. But this story is still about him. It's centered around him, right? And people, the village of Bethany is honoring him. And there we're told that Martha served. Martha was Lazarus's brother. She served at the dinner table. And Lazarus, John reminds us here again, so that we don't forget what just happened in chapter 11. Lazarus, who was once dead, is now alive and reclining with Jesus at the table. Right? So here's this little village of Bethany close to Jerusalem, and they're holding a feast, a celebration to honor Jesus and what he did. But we want to zoom out, because just before this passage, I actually don't have the verses here, we're told that the religious leaders in Jerusalem, they're angry and they want to kill Jesus. Right after Jesus did the super miracle in raising Lazarus, they get angry because people are flocking to him. They're jealous. They're losing followers, right? And they want to kill Jesus, right? So that's the greater context, right? Outside of this little village of Bethany is Jerusalem, the greater city, in Israel. And the religious leaders are indignant, wanting to kill Jesus, right? But in this little village of Bethany, where Jesus did this miracle, people are honoring him. And it's within this context of celebrating and honoring and worshiping Jesus, really, we have Mary who enters the scene, who goes even further than the village members to honor him, right? And that's in the next verse, right? Really the central part of the story. And I think we want to spend a lot of time here. Let me read it again. Mary, therefore, took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. A couple things to note. Pure nard is just, nard is a flowering plant. It's a plant found in the Himalayan mountains near Nepal and India, right? So this perfume is not a local product, right? And it's in the mountains. The flowers are found in the mountains, so hard to get. It also had to be imported to Jerusalem. And that's probably why it's so expensive. And we're told later by Judas, right? He gives an estimate as to the value of the perfume. He says it cost, they could have sold the ointment for 300 denarii. And we don't know what a denarii is, so that doesn't immediately hit us as something as expensive. But one denarii was equivalent to a common laborer's wage for a day of work, 12 hours of work. So in our culture, that would be about, 300 denarii would be about $30,000, right? So this flask of ointment that Mary had, maybe a little smaller than a can of soda, right? Cost $30,000. And Jesus, while he and Lazarus are reclining at the table, right? So Mary's not under a table, right? Stooping down and doing this under a table. But you can imagine Jesus and Lazarus, the dinner table is here and they're lying on one side and their feet are pointing outward. That's how they used to eat back then. And Mary takes on the task of a humble servant. We talked about this two months ago. Mary does what a common servant would do, but going beyond what a common servant would do, she does not wash Jesus' feet just with water and with a towel, but she uses a $30,000 ointment to anoint Jesus' feet. And she does not use a towel, but she uses her hair, something that was uncommon, and no woman would have let down her hair in public. But she does so, not thinking about what people would think of her, but she's seeing the worth, the beauty, the glory of Jesus. Remember, she had just seen Jesus raise her brother from the dead. Seeing that, she responds with such costly, humble devotion. Just want to dwell on that number for a bit, $30,000. What is that equivalent to us, like buying a car in our day and age? 30 TVs. I don't know why you would ever buy 30 TVs or almost a year's worth of tuition at Cornell. You could do a lot with $30,000. You could do so much. And yet Mary, instead of saving it, instead of selling it and amassing wealth for herself, she pours it out on Jesus' feet. $30,000 gone just like that. And I was thinking about it, like, her act of devotion and worship, the effects of it, the lasting effects of it wouldn't have lasted very long. Jesus' feet and body, right, we're told that the house is filled with fragrance. It's not going to last that long. Her act of devotion would have gone away, and in a matter of hours after dinner, if Jesus had to go somewhere, his feet would have been dirtied again. It's not like a $30,000 pedicure. Those don't exist, I don't think. That would last for at least a week or two or a month. This only lasted, the consequences at least, only lasted a couple hours maybe. But Mary thought it was worth it. Again, I've been watching the NBA Finals, so I've been thinking and looking into them, and it's said that some NBA players spend $45,000 a month on themselves, whether it's transportation or food or clothes, et cetera, entertainment, going out, $45,000 in a month. And we think, that's extravagant. That's so wasteful. Why would you ever need that much money to spend on yourself for a month? Right? I probably couldn't spend that in years. And we think that's wasteful. Yet we ought to then pause at Mary, who uses and spends $30,000 in a matter of 5 minutes. Why? Yeah, why? This story, this act of Mary ought to slow us down. It's easy to read through this and be like, yeah, Jesus is worth it. Of course, 300 denarii. Perfume. But we want to slow down and really think about, why did Mary do this? Right? I want to press that question into us. Why did she do this? Do I know Jesus like Mary did? Would I do what she did? Am I right now? Do I know Jesus in a way that I would give him everything? Everything. Right now, you and I, we don't have $30,000 women stashed in our closets, in our bathrooms. But in an equivalent way, do we know Jesus in a way that would compel us to, if he were here right before us, lavish upon him a gift, our affection, our devotion in the way that Mary did? So as I was reading this passage and thinking about it, I don't think Mary's example of devotion ought to drown us in guilt. Like, wow, I'm never going to be like Mary. I think it ought to awaken us and convict us of perhaps not seeking Jesus' glory. But yeah, primarily I think what God for you and me is inviting us, hey, look at what Mary did. Look at what she saw in my son. For you too, I will reveal my glory, my son's glory, if you seek me. I will satisfy you like I satisfied Mary, so that you too can be free from the things of the world, to truly worship me. I think this is what the passage is getting at. I think hearing and reading about what Mary did is kind of like going on Yelp. I love Yelp. Ashley and I don't go to a restaurant without checking the Yelp reviews. Makes it harder for businesses, I think. But right, when you read Or when you see that a restaurant has 5 stars, right? And the hundreds, thousands of ratings or reviews that the positive reviews that people have gotten given to the restaurant, you start salivating, you start getting hungry. You too want to go and have that steak, hamburger, etc., etc., right? Or another site that I always use is Rotten Tomatoes, right? If you see that the best critics, your friends, if you hear them raving about a movie, you too get, you start getting curious. I want to see the movie for myself and experience its glory, right? And so too, when we read this story, when we read about, Mary laying down her most precious gift, right? It ought to stir up in us, right? May God stir up in you a desire to know Jesus in the way that Mary did. Right? Mary, through her offering, clearly says to us, to Jesus, to the world, Jesus is worthy. He is glorious and he is my treasure. Greater than this gift, which does mean a lot, but Jesus is greater. It's the first part of this. The first major character of this passage is Mary, right? And we see clearly, right, the first point, the first truth and statement that I think John the writer wants to show us as we read the passage is Mary valued Jesus to the uttermost. But not everyone did, as we just read. In verses 4 to 6, we see another one of Jesus' close followers. Close not in the sense that he was intimate and loved Jesus, but close proximity-wise. Judas was one of the 12 disciples that Jesus chose. Judas spent 3 years almost with Jesus, watching him do miracle after miracle, listening to his teachings, watching Jesus love him and the other disciples and the poor, right? Even though he was with him for so long, right? Something that we would want to be, we would want to have experienced, right? To be in Jesus' presence. Even though he was with Jesus, he was completely blind to Jesus' worth, right? Let me read it again. Verses 4 to 6. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? He said this not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Right, Judas, if we were just given verse 5, right, if we weren't told that he was going to betray Jesus, if we weren't told that he had, you know, impure motives, right, for saying what he did in verse 5, sounds like a plausible, rational, you know, statement. Like, Mary, there's so many poor people around us. Why didn't you sell your ointment for $30,000 so that many, many mouths could be fed? Right? And Jesus will get to that, right, that issue. But Judas, in saying what he says in verse 5, is implying, right, indirectly saying to Jesus, to us, the reader, I don't see Jesus' value. I don't think he's worth $30,000 being spent on anointing his feet with this expensive perfume. I don't think he's worth that. Right? So Judas acts as a foil to Mary in this, right? Complete contrast. Whereas Mary saw and valued Jesus more than $30,000, Judas valued money more, right? To him, the glory of money and being rich, right, exceeded, was better than having Jesus loving him and worshiping him, right? So it's sad. I mean, again, he didn't say verse 5 because he cared for the poor, John tells us this, or because he was a thief. He was regularly taking money out of the bag used for ministry and to sustain their own needs. He was regularly helping himself to it. So he thought, man, if only the ointment was sold so that I could have helped myself to a portion of that 30,000, right? He was greedy. He did not see the glory of Jesus, but to him, money was glorious and being rich was glorious. So I think if Mary's example, if verse 3, right, if her costly devotion ought to put our lives on pause and move us into thinking and reflecting about, do we see Jesus like Mary did? Do we see the extent of his glory? Right? If Mary's story and act of worship causes us to introspect, Judas's statement is a warning. Right? These three verses serves as a warning to us. God is asking us, I think, through this passage, these three verses, what are you preoccupied with? What am I so preoccupied with? What lesser glorious things? What lesser things, lesser gods, lowercase g, what idols preoccupy my vision, my resources, my time, my energy, my thoughts, my affections, dreams, and hopes? It's a warning because these lesser glories, if they captivate us, if you are captivated by these things, you will miss out on the glory of Jesus. Christianity, the way that glory works is, right, glory meaning worth, beauty. The way that glory works is that we cannot hold two glories equally before us. One ultimately will win over our complete affection, right? Jesus says elsewhere, we cannot serve two masters, right? You will either love the one and hate the other. You cannot hold money and Jesus both in the center of your heart. Right? And again, through these verses, God is warning us, lest you turn out to be like Judas. We find out later, Judas trades in Jesus. He betrays Jesus, hands him over to Jesus' enemies for 30 pieces of silver, which is $1,000. The Lord of glory, the Son of God, God himself, given up for 30 pieces of silver, right? If, like Judas, something other than God's glory, than Jesus' glory, preoccupies our deepest affections, we too, not like exactly like Judas did, right? Jesus was already betrayed once, he cannot again. But we will betray him. We will forget about him. We will deny him before our family members, before your coworkers, before your classmates. You will deny him in your private life when no one is seeing, through your actions, right? And that is just as sinful and disastrous as what happened to Judas ultimately. All right, so through these verses, God is asking us, what are you exchanging my glory for, right? What are you... what preoccupies you? Right? The second major character of the passage, Judas, the one who so tragically was near Jesus but never saw his worth. Right? The third and last character is Jesus. Let me read these two verses again. Jesus said, "Leave her alone, Judas. Leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." Verse 7 is pretty difficult one to understand if you take time to just look at it. It's confusing. What's clear is that Jesus rebukes Judas. Judas is in the wrong. He has analyzed the situation wrongly. And he affirms Mary. She's done the right thing, Judas. Back off. Leave her alone. Right, but when you read it, Jesus says, "Leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial." It kind of sounds like Mary has some ointment left. She only used a little bit of it on Jesus. So Judas, leave her alone, lest you persuade her into selling the rest of it, right? Leave her alone so that she can keep it when I die and that she can use it for my burial. That's what it sounds like Jesus is saying. Do you guys see that in verse 7? But kind of misleading, and the translation kind of throws us in that direction, right? But the same story in Matthew and Mark, and also in this passage, we're told that Mary used all the ointment, right? Judas says in verse 5, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii?" It's implied that there's not more ointment to be sold. Mary's given it all on Jesus. She's poured it all out. There's nothing left to keep, right? So again, then verse 7 seems odd. It says, leave her alone, Judas, so that she may keep whatever is left for the day of my burial. Right? It's better to translate it, and this is not just my thinking, right? So another scholar suggests that it should be translated this way. Jesus said, leave her alone. She has kept the ointment so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. She has kept the ointment. She hasn't sold it, right, to amass wealth for herself. She hasn't sold it to even give to the poor, but she's kept it. And Jesus says here that she kept it for the day of my burial. And Mary, even though what she did, right, laying down her most precious gift, $30,000 in 5 minutes, even though what she did for her, I think, was a simple act of devotion, she was signaling to everyone, really, and to us, more than she knew, right? Jesus was, as we know, he's about to die, right? But Mary, before he dies, she does something that foreshadows, you know, what is about to come, right? She did this, she kept the ointment so that, yeah, she may keep it for the day of my burial. Does that make sense? Her act of devotion, her anointing Jesus with perfume, ointment, prefigured, foreshadowed what was about to happen. Yeah, a little confusing, even in my head still. So when people died, right, for those who were wealthy, right, you can imagine, right, people weren't buried underground back in the days. A lot of people had tombs and caves, like Jesus. And the smell would be bad, right? As the body decays, there's a terrible odor. And because of that, bodies would be covered in spices and ointments and perfumes, right? And so Mary, she's signaling more than she knew, right? In doing this, it's kind of like a sign act foreshadowing what would happen to Jesus, right? So Jesus says, leave her alone. She did what was right. I'm about to die. And she did this, not knowing it for herself, but I'm going to die soon. But astoundingly, in verse 8, he continues, leave her alone, for the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me. Right? And Jesus, he doesn't say, he doesn't deny that serving the poor is a bad thing, right? It would have been a valid use, a valid thing to do if Mary had sold the ointment and served the poor with the money that she had, she gained. He doesn't deny it, but he also doesn't deny, I am worthy of her affection and devotion. Rather, in the last part of verse 8, he says, you do not always have me. I'm not going to be here for too long. You're not going to have more, you're not going to have forever to worship me like Jesus did in the flesh. You and Mary are not going to have many opportunities to lavish upon me the worship that I deserve. One scholar points out that it would have been unspeakably arrogant for Jesus to have said this if he was a mere mortal. But you and I know that Jesus is God himself, the Son of God, the Messiah, the one who came to die for us, right? So it was right for him to speak like this. It would be wrong for you. I recently went home to my in-laws, and they're great. They cook and feed me too much, right? Too much. But if they had prepared for me a $30,000 like dinner, and I walked in the room and been like, yeah, I'm worthy of this. Good job. It's not a fitting picture, right? You would think very lowly of me, and rightly so. But for Jesus to say, I am worthy of the 5 minutes during which $30,000, 300 denarii was laid. I am worthy of it, right? It's something we don't want to miss. Jesus is saying to you and me, to Mary, to Judas, his disciples, this is my worth. And if you don't see it, then you still have way more to see. So seek me and ask the Father that you would see like Mary did. The last three verses closes up, right? It zooms out from the intimate devotion and act of worship of Mary. It zooms out, right? It says, the large crowd. When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there in Bethany, they came from, you know, assumed outside of Bethany, not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. Right, so bigger picture, everyone's hearing about what Jesus did. Again, raising Lazarus from the dead. People are flocking to him, and the leaders are jealous because they're leaving them, right, and going to this Jesus that they hate so much, right? And so at the end, right, these two groups of people kind of mirror Mary and Judas again. And Mary sees Jesus' worth. These crowds hear about Jesus' worth, so they're going to him. Judas doesn't see his worth, and neither do the chief priests, right? So really, at the end of the passage, we're being asked, do you see? How are you responding to Jesus? There's really one implication that I want to emphasize at the very end here, right? Well, before that, right, I want to summarize the passage in one sentence, if you had to. Right? And a major point of the passage is, Jesus is worthy of Mary's devotion, right? Mary saw his glory. He saw her raise her dead brother after 4 days, right, being in the tomb. She saw that he was worthy, and appropriately, she responded with this costly act of devotion, right? And the implication is this from the passage, the lesson I think we want to learn, take to heart, besides some of the things I've mentioned. At the heart of an obedient, at the heart of an obedient Christian is the seeing and perceiving of God's glory. That makes sense? I'm going to repeat it one more time. At the heart of an obedient Christian, at the heart of a Christian who is genuinely obeying and worshiping God and Jesus, is one who has seen his worth and beauty. A couple of weeks ago, I said that, right, when we were looking at John 15, I said that there's a place for godly fear. There's a place to fear God's judgments and warnings. There's a place to heed the warnings of judgment, right? If you do not abide in me, right, God will take you out and throw you into the fire. There's a place in our devotional life and our meditating. And there's a place to meditate on those warnings, right? Because those warnings keep us within God's presence, away from sin, and within the good, glorious presence of God. But although fear, godly fear, is a good motivation, I think there is a more foundational motivation for our obedience and worship. And that is, we worship not because we fear, right? We do fear, but we worship primarily because we have seen his glory. That's why when you go to Revelation 4 and these passages in Revelation, right? What will preoccupy a lot of our time in heaven is seeing God in all of his beauty, and over and over and over again until there is no end to eternity. But for all eternity, you and I, beholding God's glory, will say, worthy are you. Worthy are you. Right? There's that passage when the 24 elders take their crowns and continue again and again to throw their crowns at the feet of Jesus and God, because they see God's glory and the glory of the Son. There is no fear in heaven. There's no fear of being cast out, because in heaven, you and I will behold his glory perfectly, and we worship and we do not sin, because we are so wholeheartedly captured by the magnificence and the weight of his glory. But before heaven, while we are on earth, right, this is the call for you and me to seek out the glory of the Son and the Father. To seek it out. So, yeah, in the Word, in fellowship, in prayer, in reading good Christian books, especially in the Word, right? Again, the summer is a is often a time where people kind of sit back and relax more and get more lazy. But I ask you, I've been challenged and convicted by this passage. How am I, how are you going to spend this summer? What are you going to commit yourself to? And God, through this passage, is saying, commit yourself to seeking me. You will not be disappointed. You will be disappointed if you seek other glories, right? Like Judas was, like many people are on this campus. But you, you having heard the story of Mary, right? Will you continue to ponder it, ponder her act of devotion? Will you, my son, my daughter, right? Think about what Mary has done and continue to ask, why did she do it? Why did she do it? She must have seen something in Jesus that I don't yet fully see. I've tasted a little bit, but man, I want to know more. And so may you commit, may we commit as a church to going before God daily and asking, opening up the word and praying before we read, Lord, open up my eyes to behold your wonder, your wondrous character, and the glory of your Son. So, yeah, let's take a moment to pray, and you can respond. Let's respond to God on an individual basis. Yeah, perhaps some of you need to recommit yourselves to, again, not because, you know, we all have to be like Mary. Yes, we are a call to imitate her, I think, but perhaps God is inviting you to commit yourself to seeking again, recommitting yourself to seeking God again. And for some of you, you have been waiting. You are seeking. And the thing is, you know, like, even if we commit ourselves to that, seeing His glory does not often happen as fast as we would wish. And God is wise in his timing, right? Continue to wait, right? Continue to wait. So let's go before God in prayer.